Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service, the only opportunity offered to the broader community to be informed on the issues and current affairs from a First Nations perspective. This is Carver Watson with Let's Talk.
We acknowledge the continuing sovereignty of all First Nations people across the country where this program is broadcast. We acknowledge elders, elders of the First People of the land, and elders of more recent arrivals. We welcome all our listeners tuned in to the National Indigenous Radio Service, as well as wherever you are if you're streaming via the web. This morning on Let's Talk, we have one of our new Let's Talk host for 2017, Chelsea Bond. Welcome to the studio.
Thanks, Carver.
It's great to have your company, and we're really looking forward to hearing a bit about your story today and what we can expect. But before we get into that, tell us a bit about your mob and your country.
My mob, so I am Mananjali through the Yugambeh language group through the Williams family on my father's side. I'm also a South Sea Islander through my father's family and the Wadigo name, because that's my maiden name. Mm. And I also have English and Irish heritage through the Cox family on my mother's side.
So a little bit of everything. Yeah. You can throw a bit of a Nala in there too, eh?
Well, yes. I don't think I can say I come from there, because I've only lived there like 16 years or so.
Years, yeah.
I'm new to the neighbourhood.
All good. So tell us a bit about your sort of, your upbringing and your journey.
Yeah, so I grew up in the outer suburbs of Brisbane in a suburb called Runcorn and Southside.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm the youngest of four. I'd say a working poor family. So mum and dad both worked. Mum did shift work at Telecom back in the day. Mm. And my dad was a self-employed truck driver. And they worked long and hard. We had a very, it's funny. I would say we have a very privileged upbringing in the sense that we were materially poor, but, Dad would always say, you'll always have clothes on your back and food on the table and a place to sleep. Might not have the fanciest house, but you'll have the things that you need. Mum used to sew all their clothes as kids, and I remember things often being tight financially. We knew that there wasn't a lot to go around, but we always had the what we needed, and we all played sports, and Dad tried to get us to play musical instruments, but we didn't practice those very much.
It's funny you say that, because my old man used to say something, things similar. We, while we didn't have a lot of the material possessions in the world, he'd always say, we're richest than the richest millionaires.
Hey.
Because that the richness of our connections and relationships with family, so important.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. And I remember, in high school, and friends come walk to your house and you walk to school together. And I used to feel ashamed because we always had a bed in our lounge room. And my friends would say, why have you got a... We didn't have coffee tables the sort of lounge settings and the TV unit. We had the TV with the TV on top and, the...
the TV, TV stand.
Yeah, the TV stand. And my answer to them was, because cousin's over, auntie or uncle. And for them, I had lots of family that I claimed as cousins or aunties or uncles. But our lounge room was, a lot of the time in our childhood, a place where family stayed while visiting Brisbane, because Dad is the eldest of five, and we're the only of his family that are living in Brisbane. Mm. We've got half our family down Tweed Heads and the other half in Bowen in North Queensland. Which is
so use the stop off
with the Brisbane
stop over,
Brisbane Wadigos, and it was a place where people could stay, and home was a place where people can stay at any time. And so, Dad would always used to say, "Make yourself at my place." And it was we grew up with the sense of even if you don't have much, you still have a responsibility to share. And it is a privileged position to be able to even give.
Mm.
So kind of thinking about that in that way. So I grew up with a strong sense of social justice in our home, the sense of responsibility for...
looking after each other.
Looking after each other.
Yeah.
And, some of it was, I think, informed by... we had a Christian upbringing in our childhood. So there was this sense of... It was, sometimes phrased in that kind of... ethic, but it was a mixture of being a black fellow as well as, a duty to look after people in need. And I didn't, what was funny when I look back at my childhood, by today's standards, when we look at families and we look at issues of poverty, as a child, I didn't realise that poverty was something that was demonised or seen as a problem, because we were materially poor but very proud, and we all played sports and did well at school and had strong family networks and stuff. So it sort of surprises me now as an adult when we talk about class in this country, the way in which poor people are demonised as somehow not hardworking or, don't have aspirations. And, I it's funny now looking at class in a different kind of way, because I wasn't aware at the time that we were... I knew we didn't have much, but I didn't really understand the way in which it's framed in sort of in the conversations about us. And so living in Inala, which is, like the... one of the poorest areas in Queensland outside of the discrete Aboriginal communities, I hear a lot of the talk about poor neighbourhoods and poor people, and it's really confusing to me, because I don't I don't get it, because it's not what my reality was.
Well, you're sort of what you've been renowned for in more recent years is, I guess, your work in academia. And sorry to sort of jump back and forth here, but from an academic standpoint in your studies, why do you see that conversation? Why do you see, what are the factors you think have contributed to that sort of demonisation, as you call it, of, poor income families?
That's a hard question, Carla.
Hey, you're Dr. Chelsea Bond. I forgot to tell everyone.
I haven't theorised about that one much. I guess for me, going to university was a way in which I could start to question some of the taken for granted things in our social world. So as a child, I didn't think about race and class. I lived the experience of it, but I hadn't thought about why and how that all comes about. So it was, for me, going to university at like 17 years of age, I suddenly become aware of these concepts and making sense of them and realising, oh, it's because... And interrogating some of the knowledge that's been created about the poor, the black, the ethnic other, so to speak. So it's given me a sort of, I guess, a more critical consciousness about some of these things, and realising that we can't just attribute poverty to people not working hard enough. We have to look at the structural factors in place that reinforce and ensure that there is income inequality in this country. And too often we trade on stereotypes, whether it's poor people or black people or refugees, and don't look at the systems and structures in our society that actually create those divisions and enforce them.
It's a way of sort of simply, I've always thought, a way of simply explaining difficult or complex social issues. You know, when we talk about poverty, we talk about racial inequality and the socioeconomic status and its effects. These are complex issues, but when we can just say, they don't work hard, that mob, it's a very easy way of dealing or not having to deal with these social issues.
An easy way and a lazy way to deal with it. And, I don't think I have the answers on all of these things. But I've certainly, it's given me the tools to then ask different questions. So, once upon a time, I think as a young person, when people would say things about Aboriginal people, I would kind of try and contest them with, positive stories as a kind of, and now I actually sort of look back and go, okay, hang on, what is this discourse doing? How is it working? Whose benefits it's serving? Rather than internalising some of that stuff.
Yeah.
Because it is so easy to internalise the things that are said about us, because we hear them all the time from everywhere.
And sometimes the things that aren't said, though, too. The things that are not said. It's just the expectations and the way we are treated, the way our young people are treated when they come into contact with the criminal justice system or the police system.
There was even the recent Struggle Street documentary, and it's apparently filming in Inala, or has been in more recent times, and I wrote about that because it was the silence about the everyday stories of people in Inala that I was concerned about, that their first series in Mount Druitt focused on a stereotypical imagining of a resident in that community, and we can reproduce the same story in Inala that is in Mount Druitt that they showed. But I know lots of hardworking people that have lived in an island for generations who are not injecting drug users, who are great parents, who are actively involved in their community. Yeah. Absolutely. And what concerned me about that series was it was silent about the deadly poor people in our society who are doing great things and who are poor not because they choose to be or because there's something wrong with them. They live in a world in which income inequality is a real thing. And so, yeah, that issue of silence, I think, it concerns me. There is lots of silence about the experience of Indigenous people, of poor people, that conveniently get left out. So people trade on these stereotypes about us.
Yeah, absolutely. To step back again now, you said the ripe old age of 17, you went on to university. What were you, tell us about your educational journey through uni.
Yeah, look, I was first in family to go to university.
No pressure.
Many of us are, I think. Yeah. And I'd finished school at 16 in grade 12 because I was like a year younger than my cohort. And I did have a bit of a rocky kind of period in my senior high school years. Didn't make the best choices. Prior to that, I was a kind of an overachiever and, you know, student council and did well academically. But from grade 10 to grade 12, you know, it's a time of
turmoil. Runcorn was rubbing off.
Well, the mean old streets of Runcorn. And so I was fairly disengaged from high school my senior years where it mattered, and I didn't have a good OP school. But I had an OP school, and it was the school's policy. If you had an OP school, you had to fill out a QTAC application, which is the entry to university. And I hadn't really thought about what I wanted to do. And when I went to the guidance office and they said, so what are your career aspirations? I said, I don't know. I just want to work with my mob. And it just so happened that there were two courses. There was one at Lismore around being a paralegal in Indigenous justice stuff, and there was an Indigenous health, applied health science degree at the University of Queensland. And I got accepted and thought, oh, okay, I'll give it a go. And I loved the course, and I went from being a student who was getting low achievements in senior years of high school to getting straight sevens in my first semester because I found my thing and I was just it was something I was passionate about, and and it was a cohort of mostly Indigenous students who were coming through that course, and a mixture of young school leavers and mature age students, and it was such an important learning journey for me, not just academically but culturally as well, because we had some, you know, great heated debates every day about Indigenous issues, and I was learning from, say, our elders, but learning from mob with life experience, and it was so, it was a really privileged learning journey for me to have that at, you know, the age of 17 to 19 kind of thing.
You would have been getting into those books because everything else everybody's getting into, you got to wait another year. So all you would have been able to do was study. But so you don't get a doctorate for an Indigenous health course. Where did your interest in further study come from?
Well, it was funny. I only did a PhD because I decided, I'd just gotten married and wanted to have kids and stuff. And so I thought, well, while I stay at home, Mum, I might as well do something while, you know, keep myself busy, because I've never not worked. Like, as soon as I was 14 and 9 months, I went and got a part-time job, and we've come from the working family, so it's all about work ethic and get a job and all that kind of stuff. And so it was, I had been working as an Aboriginal health worker out at Dalby for a couple of years. I'd come back to Brisbane because my husband was studying at the time, and I'd picked up some work doing research work with the University of Queensland, and I was kind of getting annoyed at the research work that I was having to do, because it was all about, okay, let's do surveys with young people, Indigenous young people, about drug and alcohol consumption. Let's do interviews with Indigenous people about their experiences in detention centres. And it was all very deficit-based. I'd have to go to my own community and say, tell me what is wrong with you, what is wrong with us, what is wrong with our community. And I was really annoyed at it. And so I thought, well, I want to do a PhD and I want to ask something that I want to ask without the same values and assumptions that are in the other research questions that I've been asked to be involved in. And I kind of wanted to speak back to public health and how it had kind of imagined indigeneity. So what I decided to do was to look at Aboriginality as defined by Indigenous people, and look at how that the disjuncture between our narratives of identity versus the public health narratives of Indigeneity, which see Indigenous status as a risk factor for illness, which see it as just this fixed category that's supposed to mean something, and often the meaning is about how it causes our sickness. And we know as blackfellas, our identity does not make us sick, though the conditions we're exposed to do.
It does the opposite.
It does. It's the centre of being strong and well. So there's a real difference. And so what I liked, the for me, doing postgrad studies was to be able to speak back to this body of literature that continues to reproduce this racial hierarchy that insists that there's something wrong with us. And go, no, hang on a minute.
That's probably one of the greatest sentences I've ever heard on radio,
oh,
Chelsea. Just for the record.
And lots of blackfellas in the academy are doing that. It's an exciting time. We've got lots of Indigenous students doing postgraduate degrees, speaking back to the disciplines they were trained in to say, no, hang on a minute, the knowledge produced about us is actually wrong. And this is actually, let's centre Indigenous knowledges, let's speak to Indigenous realities and experiences and contest this, because that's how we combat racism. It's not just getting people to like us. It's about changing the way that the types of knowledge that's being produced in our institutions. So I'm inspired by the sense of activism that comes with being an Indigenous academic.
Absolutely,
No, I
think it's a wonderful contribution, and, you know, it's the same contribution that our people have made in whatever industry and whatever sort of sector that we find ourselves. We do it here in media. We do it in education through places like the Murray School and other, you know, Indigenous studies units in tertiary institutions. So it's that common trait, no matter where we are in this country, that our people are sharing our views and advocating our voice in whatever circumstances we find ourselves, and which you've done through academia. So I'm sorry to keep banging on with the education thing, but I understand the process. So that was Masters.
I know I did. So I did my honours. I didn't do Masters.
Okay,
when I was out working at Dalby as a health worker, I did my honours degree full-time. And it's only because I had a non-Indigenous academic who taught me in undergrad and said, look, you're really smart, not to big note. He said that, not me.
Yeah.
You need to do postgrad studies. You need to, and he nagged me and said, so when are you going to do honours? When are you going to enrol? And so I did an honours degree, which is like a one-year research degree, and came back and did research work and then decided to have kids and went, okay, well, I'm going to do a PhD.
So that was the PhD.
Yeah.
My bad.
That's okay. Yeah. It's that language, eh?
That's it. So I briefly spoke and before mentioned Inala, and the only reason I raise it is, well, I actually first met you in Inala.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, and it was it was probably my first year out of school, and I was doing some work with the Style and Up Festival, working with Barney and Zenny and the Intruder Boys, and I went to school with, you know, Reed Boys and Bonner Boys, and so yeah, so shout out to Inala. But I know you've always been an advocate and speaking about the positive aspects of what you know, our mob and our community, and the strength of community, in sort of all forums, and I guess tell us a bit about where you see the state of our communities now and the challenges that face us in terms of continuing to maintain that strength within community.
Yeah, look, I mean, I think we've seen since the 70s and, you know, there's been a real urban shift of our Indigenous populations. And we still have discrete Aboriginal communities, but we have this growing urban Indigenous population. And it's something that I'm conscious of, in the sense that I grew up in Brisbane. Our first cousins were not in Brisbane. And we were like the one Aboriginal family at our primary school and our high school, maybe a couple other families from time to time. And that wasn't, I think, a healthy place to grow up in terms of the issue of racial socialisation and having a sense of identity and self. And I met an Inala boy and got married to him. But it was when I was living out at Dalby, there was a real sense of lived community. While it's not a distinct Aboriginal community, there is a distinct community within Dalby. And there was a sense of community, like, every day. And, you know, you bump into mob all the time every day. And I don't think people realise that when you're not – when you're a minority – what it's like to not encounter people that are like you on a daily basis, because we don't see ourselves on TV so much, or, you know, we're not included in national narratives, but we're absent from a lot of that. So
I've always thought, you know, especially for Emma, we're very conscious of our difference, that we are different, you know, and are conscious of a difference. And I'm not sure if that's taught or sort of learnt or sort of where that comes from. But, you know, when people talk about white privilege, I often think about in the terms of, you'll hear non-Indigenous people say things that Murrays wouldn't always say or feel comfortable saying, you know. And that, to me, speaks to that sense of, you know, we're very conscious. We're conscientious of who we are and not being like sort of exactly like everyone else. Yeah,
and I think if you're only exposed to predominantly non-Indigenous people and their imaginings of Indigeneity that are visited upon you, it can be really damaging identity-wise. So we're living at Dalby, and I love the sense of community as a live-daily thing. And when we came back to Brisbane, I was like, well, of course, we moved to Inala, because when we were living in Brisbane, we were going to Inala all the time for events, and you know, like, we were sort of living there socially. And so we were, you know, planning to start a family. And for us, it was about giving our kids a healthy environment to grow up in, which for most people, they go, Inala's not a healthy place to grow up in. And if you haven't lived there, or don't know it, or don't understand the importance of community in shaping identity and stuff. So for us, it was a conscious decision to go, well, we want our kids growing up with a healthy sense of self. And for us, that's actually living in a community where they're going to bump into auntie at the civic. They're going to have other Murray kids in their class. They're not going to be the only one.
Yeah.
And, you know, for our kids, when they first started Nala State School, it's part of their learning. Of course, they learned song and dance as part of their educational environment, and they had you know, young Nala fellas teaching them dance, and they were doing dances from the country that they've got bloodline connections to. And I can't get that in an anonymous white suburban school for my kids. So there's things that I really value about Inala in terms of, they go to the Murray preschool. All my kids went through Wandara, because it's an institution in that place, you know, the Wandara days. And when they play football, most of the kids they play in the football team are black fellas.
It's something that, it's, you know, if mob haven't sort of been there or know people from there, something that I was always conscious of, in, you know, known people like you know, Barney and others, and Inala mob, it was always something they spoke of with pride, you know. And it still is.
4077.
That's it. Inala boys, you know, there was a very strong sense of community. And even over sort of time, that grew from just being Murrays to incorporate other groups who also live there.
Absolutely.
You know?
And I think sometimes people think that when we want to hang out in spaces where other Indigenous people are, that we somehow can't engage with non-Indigenous people, or that we're too scared or mild. It's not about that. It's actually having, on a daily basis, there are safe places where I don't have to encounter whiteness, you know, where it's, we can take a break from having to be the problem or the other.
Or feel different.
Feel different.
I
love that my, you know, the kids' school, it is so culturally diverse. I hate that word, but it's so culturally diverse. And my middle child, he changed schools from an Inala State school to a private school. And his first week, he said to me, this is really weird. And this was there, he was like 9 or 10. He said, all the boys here are named Harry or Angus. There's no Mustafas, no Sundays. And no one speaks another language. And he was really confused by it, because he encountered this whole other world where most of the students were non-Indigenous white Australians, Harry and Charles and Angus. And it confused him, because it was such a different place to be in. And I think people don't realise that Australia, where we talk, a lot of Australians say, we don't have a culture, but yeah, we do. And you can see it across this city and different suburbs, how different life is. Yeah, people can often be blind to that. If you're the norm, if you're the accepted, you don't question some of these things. You don't take for granted that you will encounter people that talk like you, that validate you, that affirm you. They don't interrogate your identity or that kind of stuff. And so we do have to find safe spaces as blackfellas in this country to be able to just be without having to justify or explain our existence or why we do things in a different kind of way.
Mm. Brings us back to what we were talking about and creating that space in tertiary institutions and in academia. Our guest today is Dr. Chelsea Bond on Let's Talk. We might take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll continue our yarn.
You're tuned to Let's Talk, a weekly current affair program hosted by First Nations people for First Nations peoples. This is Carver Watson with Let's Talk.
Welcome back to Let's Talk. Our guest today, Dr. Chelsea Bond, who is joining our group of hosts this year in 2017. So make sure you tune in throughout the year to hear Chelsea speaking with various guests. But right now we are learning a little bit and getting to know Chelsea a bit better. And we've spoken about her upbringing, her educational journey and the wonderful work she does. Her journey to becoming a doctor and the work she's done since. But now we'd like to take a different sort of approach and take a step back and talk about some current affairs that have been going on, and everybody's been talking about it, and we'd love to hear your views. I'll start with before Invasion Day. Did you catch that LAM ad? The MLA LAM ad?
I did.
Yeah.
I'm trying to... I did.
Yeah? You don't sound too enthusiastic about it.
Well, it was... I mean... I have had many questions about the LAM ad.
Mm-hmm. I thought, where is that beach? That looks like an awesome beach.
True. Yeah. Well, I was just wondering about the new boat people that they referenced.
Yeah.
Because they never got to land. Every other boat was able to come to the shores, but the new ones, they did. Yeah. You go watch that ad. They didn't get to land. And they, so are we? Is the, you know, like what's the
subliminal messaging?
I mean, did they do it deliberately to get us to question that? I don't think many people did question it.
They caused a bit of a discussion, though, and a bit of a... They've got a reputation for being provocative and winding people up.
And they tried to change the angle this year, it seems, from previous years, because there are previous LAM ads where no Indigenous Australians were allowed to come to the celebration and weren't on the guest list, when there was the one where they invited these prominent Australians and they got random ones, but not one of them was an Indigenous Australian. So I was like, oh, wow, how telling, we're not invited to the party. Mm. Not sure I'd go, but... Yeah.
Now we're the life of the party.
Hey, we're the best party in town.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, the peaceful arrival was, you know, not surprising in the ad, because that's what we tell our kids in school, and, you know, that's the myth that we continue to, portray. Mm. I did see the, I think, Cope Street mob, the blackfellas did an Indigenous version of the LAM ad, which was more accurate, I would say.
Bo Sprim was in here earlier in the week. He said the exact same thing.
Yeah, it was.
I think that reaction tells us all you think about it.
Yeah.
So moving on, we've, you know, I guess it's a good segue to talk about Invasion Day, Australia Day debate. And it's not going away. You know, we've had a record number of people turn out this year to Invasion Day rallies across the country. Some 50,000 reported in...
How good was Melbourne?
Melbourne, yeah. Oh. And even here in Brisbane, yeah, numbers are increasing, and the same across the country. And it's playing into this change the date debate, if you will. Where do you see this conversation going, or do you have a view on this conversation?
I'm rolling my eyes here in the studio. Look, change the date is kind of like recognise. You know, it's well-meaning, or people think that, well, I'm pro-Indigenous issues because I'm on this campaign, mm-hmm. and not actually... asking deeper questions of it.
Mm.
I think that where our nation is currently at, it is fitting that Australia Day is celebrated on the 26th of January, because it tells us who we are as a nation.
It's an interesting
and how
take,
we
yeah.
see ourselves. If you think about the outrage at the Muslim girls on the billboard who were celebrating Australia Day and ended up getting pulled and I think put back up again, but it got pulled because people thought it was terrible.
Mm.
That tells us that many Australians are stuck on the idea of a white Australia,
that
the defining moments of this nation's history is white invasion. And we're not comfortable thinking about Australia as being non-white. So the fact that we have this day of celebration on this day as a nation, not we, me, but the nation, it's a mirror that tells us who we are and how we see ourselves. And I think we can't actually change the date until we reconfigure how we see ourselves as a nation. I mean, I still remember being in primary school and I brought a school photo home, and at that school at the time wasn't culturally diverse, but there were a few non-white Australians in my class photo. And I remember my neighbour at the time going, oh, it's like Spot the Aussie in here. Yeah, it was the 80s.
Was it as awkward as it would be now?
And I just don't think that there are many Australians who believe that this nation and what should be celebrated, commemorated, is all about white achievement and accomplishment. If you think about what we were all taught in school, we were taught about the explorers who were all white, who discovered the land in which we come from. Funny that. And so our whole society is structured around celebrating, you know, that particular kind of Australia. And until we actually reconfigure that and think about who we are as a nation, what does it mean to be Australian in a way that is actually inclusive in a more meaningful way, in an everyday way, we can't pick another date, because shifting the date doesn't actually shift
attitudes
and
views.
And it kind of, if we were to say next year shift the date and do the 8th, was the 8th of May the mate thing? It's kind of a lie. We're lying to ourselves. Because we don't, as a nation,
actually believe
that everyone's welcome to, you know, enjoy their land and be part of the, you know, the nation and celebrate it. I mean, I saw recently when Mundine's stance about the sitting for the national anthem, and our PM Turnbull weighed in and said, you know, it's absurd and our anthem is inclusive of all Australians. No, our anthem's a lie. It is absolute lie. But he's, you know, I guess, he's lying to the nation, because that's not what we are as a nation. We are not young and free.
There's still a very distinct, and I guess you'd see it in your work as you continue to work in universities, there's still such a disparity between the accepted histories in this country for First Peoples, our peoples across this country, and, you know, right through from, you know, 10th, 12th, as many generations Australians who've come to even newer groups and more recent migrant groups. There's still this disparity in what actually took place here and the history of this country.
And it's a real contradiction. So you come across around, you know, 26th of January, all these proud Australians. But if you go to them and say, well, tell us about this land that you call home, who are the mob that come from this place? What's the history of this place? Not just the colonial history, but the history prior to that. They have no idea. So I'm kind of like, if you're so proud of this country, then why do you only know a little bit of it? Why don't you want to know all about your country that you claim so proudly? And, you know, I teach into an Aboriginal Studies major at the University of Queensland, and every year I get students who have no understanding about their history, because that legislation, we didn't draft that legislation. The Protections Act, we did not draft that. That's their history. It's and the idea that it's somehow Indigenous history, no, that's their history. That's this country's history. And, you know, you look at the Protection Act in Queensland, I mean, there's not one black fella alive here that does not have a relationship with that legislation. It affected the lives of all Indigenous people from the 1890s through to the 1970s, and then some more in Queensland, because we had Joe Brecker Peterson, which kind of kept some of those things in place a lot longer. How can people not know about that? And I always encounter these students who are in shock going, you know, to quote Henry Reynolds, why weren't we told? And I go, it's fascinating why we haven't, why you mob haven't told yourselves about your own history. And they don't own that history.
No.
That's actually their history.
And that's part of the, I guess, it doesn't fit with this idea of nationhood that, I guess, has been taught for so many years, you know. And there's, I guess, the issue is that there's still a reluctance to sort of, you know, I always think the good, the bad and the ugly, you know. So I always used to say, you know, unless you know the true history of this country, we'll never form an understanding and a relationship to build a more harmonious society. And I think that still remains true to this day, you know, in that we need to own it, you know.
And the other thing is, when I teach students about our history as a nation and how it has applied to Indigenous peoples, I teach them not to make them feel guilty or bad. I actually use as a way for them to get a sense of Indigenous resistance, resilience, agency, because it's through that they discover how deadly our mob are, how, you know, the ways in which we have resisted and continue to resist. You know, there's that whole myth that we didn't put up a fight. Our mob have been resisting for a long time in really clever ways that demonstrates to non-Indigenous Australians we're not sitting around on welfare going, woe is me, we're victims. These historical stories reveal to us the amazing resilience of Indigenous peoples and our knowledges and expertise. So I use it as a way for them to encounter Indigenous strength, not do white guilt. And that's where Howard lied to the nation about learning about our history. It's about, you know, a black armband view. It's not about that. It's actually getting them to feel a sense of knowing us in a deeper way and knowing themselves in a deeper way also.
Coming back to your point that you were saying earlier, you know, if you're truly passionate about this country and being Australian, then, you know, the embracement of our history and our history, you know, after colonisation and the achievements of our people to date, you know, we're not sitting around doing nothing, like you said.
Yeah.
We're building radio stations.
Hey, schools.
We're building schools, you know. We're putting our mark wherever we've been, and we continue to do it. And, I mean, that history, again, is there and available to be welcomed and embraced by all people and form part of the story of this country. But look, I know we're going to be talking about these issues for a long time to come, so I thought we may just change the pace. This is your first show here with us on 98.9. What can we expect from Dr. Chelsea Bond as a host of Let's Talk? What are some of your sort of interests and the sort of things that you'd like to discuss with our listeners?
Well, I'm going to do what I do in teaching, and I'm going to talk a little bit, but I'm going to actually introduce you to a whole lot of interesting blackfellas and non-Indigenous people who are working in our space and doing really interesting work. But I think it's going to be a mixture. I want to talk to some everyday blackfellas. I want to talk to some academic blackfellas. And I want to kind of look at some of the issues that are topical at the time. But I really want to just, I guess, give listeners an opportunity to meet more awesome Indigenous people.
Deadly. We look forward to it, and we thank you for joining our stable of hosts this year. On behalf of all of our listeners, welcome Dr. Chelsea Bond, and yeah, we'll catch you in Let's Talk in the episodes to come.
You've been tuned to Let's Talk, highlighting the injustice from community to country, suburb to city, with a multitude of hosts, Bo Spearham, Carver Watson, the aunties Lilla Watson and Mary Graham, and Chelsea Bond. Weekday mornings from 9 till 10, it's Let's Talk, welcoming the continued sovereignty of all First Nations peoples right across the country.